We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
And welcome to the podcast. There has been an actual basketball game involving Pelicans players. I am so excited. I'll be honest, I was kind of just giddy all yesterday thinking that basketball is actually coming up and despite all of, like, the sadness in the last podcast, Michael, are you sad? Are you excited? What are you feeling about the season right now?
Pumped. I'm glad that we got through one game and nobody got injured. I will say...
High watermark.
Yeah, I will say I'm kind of disappointed that Nicholas Brusciano went for 13 on us. Brusciano, or I don't know. I honestly don't know half of the guys who played for the Mavs yesterday. There's a Hornsby in there, but anyway,
the Collinsworth.
Yeah. No,
I thought it was like maybe Kerry Collinsworth, but then isn't he a football player?
Kerry. Oh, you're thinking of Chris Collinsworth. Yeah.
Or maybe Kerry Collins.
Yeah. Now this one, I do think it's his son. I believe if it's the guy I'm thinking about, went to BYU last year. Yeah, it is Kyle Collinsworth, and he was a triple double machine at the U. He's a legend here in Provo. He's going to be in the next parade. So, there is a citywide parade last year. Jimmer was in it on the back of a Mustang. So it's a pretty big deal. And good old Kyle will be here next year. So, yeah, it was – nobody got hurt. Biggest takeaway, best thing that happened.
Yeah. I do have to ask you the question because you've kind of brought it up. If you scroll down the box score for the Mavericks, when games are real and people are actually playing the roles that you expect for the Mavericks, how many of the names in this box score actually appear in a box score in a real season game?
So Barea, Anderson, Powell, and Barnes. So four of the starting five, although not in as high usage roles as they had to play in this game. And maybe Seth Curry. So maybe five of these guys will play in the actual Mavericks rotation.
Yeah, and I think only probably two of them are starters.
Yeah,
Barnes and Powell. Maybe Anderson. Anderson might start.
Yeah. But I mean, it was good to have them back. Got to watch a little bit of the game on the live stream. The highlights are up now as well. Got to peruse through those. I know there's things. I mean, the funniest thing to me is that what I've seen in the little that I looked on Twitter message boards is you'll see people say something to the effect of, oh my God, did you see Etwan Moore, 19 points on 12 shots, and then, yeah, I think Terrence Jones is back. He scored 17 and all that. And then somebody would be like, yeah, but Solomon Hill looked terrible. And the same people who are optimistic are like, it's only one game. How could it only be one game when it's bad, but then you're over here getting all excited about it? Like, it has to be one or the other. Either it means something or it means nothing. But watching people kind of cherry pick that is my favorite part of any sports preseason.
So here's what I will say about the preseason. My take is you can watch this, and if guys are playing really, really well, it's meaningless, really. It's meaningless. If they're playing really terrible, that's meaningful. Because generally guys who are playing really terrible, they're not going to cut it when the real games start either.
Yeah.
So, and I look at what Solomon Hill did in that game, and I know people are just looking at the box score and being like, he didn't score any points. He only took three shots. He didn't get many rebounds. I'm like, the one number that pops out to me is four assists. When was the last time we had a small forward who got four assists?
Yeah, and I mean, we'd have to watch a little closer to see if that was...
if they matter.
Yeah. But no, my one takeaway is along the same lines of, first of all, as I've gotten older and I think understood the game a little more, I look at points less and less in any situation because, you know, unless you're talking about an elite score, that's kind of random. Etwan Moore takes the same 12 shots in the next game, literally the same amount open, the same, you know, whatever. He's not going to score 19 points in every game. In some games he'll have 11, in some games he'll have 22. That's completely random, and it's just something that doesn't carry over from game to game unless you're a top-tier scorer who's very consistent. What I look at is, you said Solomon Hill assists. I look at the fact that Tim Frazier got 6 rebounds, the fact that Buddy Hield got 6 rebounds, and Etwan Moore got 4. We are coming off of 4-plus years, which really translated into like 38 games of Eric Gordon. And I mean, you would go crazy about how Eric Gordon wouldn't do anything else in the .com, specifically rebounds, specifically things like help defense. Those are the things that I look at more, and the fact that, you know, we had 3 guards who in very limited minutes, I mean, all of their per 36s would be somewhere between like 7 and 10 rebounds. Those are the kind of things that would get me more excited than points.
Yeah, guys who might actually help out and more than their one thing they want to do.
Yeah, no, that's good. Ball, I mean, I know I've seen some people say they're excited about the ball movement and the assists and just the general moving of the ball. I saw that in Summer League last year. I heard it preached in the preseason last year and done a little bit. To me, you know, if we go back about 3 years, I would love to actually do this. I want to go back about 3 years and listen to the podcast that we had Amin on, because he basically predicted what was going to happen with the Tyreek, Eric Gordon, Drew Holiday thing. He said if things are going well and the team's winning, everybody's unselfish, everybody's happy, they play their roles and it's good basketball, you start losing, guys start trying to do too much, there's some backbiting, I'm not starting, yada, yada, yada. That's the same thing here, is I could hear all the, yeah, we're going to move the ball, we're going to play as a team, we're going to play hard. But then they do that and they start 3-8. Then we'll see if it's really something that they're going to do, you know, in the sunshine and the rain, or if it's just something that they're going to do when everything's going well and they say they're going to do it. So there's still a long way to go. I am not fully bought in to this team playing the way that they need to play, even though I know they want to, even though I know the coaches are preaching it. Let's see what happens when the struggles start coming up. Let's see if the guys are as unselfish as they are right now.
All right. It'll be interesting to see how that plays. And there's going to be some really unpleasant spans of the season, I'm still pretty sure. So we'll see how they can handle with those moments. What is nice is, in some respects, let's say a couple of these guards decide they're going to start acting that way. We got plenty of other guards. Like, there is some depth on this team.
Yeah, especially when Drew and Pondexter comes back. I mean,
yeah.
It could be a problem. It could be a good problem to have. Imagine all these guys play up to their potential, plus Drew and Pondexter come back. I mean, you could be overwhelmed with a lot of wings. You could do a lot of different things. So, but you brought up Solomon Hill specifically. So there's just a couple things from this game that I want to get some bigger picture ideas on. And so let's talk about Solomon Hill. Let's imagine that at the end of the year, we could fast forward and look at the end of the year as Basketball Reference, and he played about 28 minutes a game. He went 2 for 4.5 from the field on average. Let's say 1 for 2.5 for 3, so, 40%. 1 for 1.2 for free throws. I'm being really specific here, but...
I like your decimal.
Yeah, thing. So I got decimal.
Bad flavor.
So, I mean, he hit all his normal percentages, but the guy put up 6 points a game. He put up, let's go with 3 assists, 4 or 5 rebounds. How good would his defense and tangibles, whatever else, have to be for you to say that he lived up to or is worth the contract moving forward if he's not putting up the numbers that casual fans associate with a valuable player?
You put pretty blisteringly poor numbers there, but if those were the numbers, he'd have to be being first team all defense. Like, I'm sorry. Especially if we're talking like 30, 34 minutes, somewhere between there, right?
I was saying 20. I think he's 28 when Quincy gets back. 26, 28, yeah. 26, 28, yeah. 6 points a game. But again, on 4.5 shots, so, fine shooting.
Mm-hmm.
He has a super low usage.
Yeah, he'd have to be giving me more in the way of rebounds and steals and blocks and just defense. Like, he'd have to be pretty special defensively. Like, you can't, like, the numbers you're actually illustrating there are Dante Cunningham-esque. And we all know how I feel about Dante Cunningham.
Well, what if I'm thinking more along the lines of like an Andre Roberson?
Okay.
I mean, who I wouldn't know. I should probably have looked ahead and seen what he puts up per game. But I'm thinking about a guy who basically never touches the ball. What do you think Bruce Bowen put up on average in his 8 seasons in San Antonio? How many points per game?
I would have guessed 9.
Yeah, 7.8.
Okay.
So, on average, he shot 3 of 7 from the field. I'm surprised. Less than half of his shots were from 3. I always thought he was basically 3s or nothing else.
He migrated there.
Yeah.
It took him a couple of years to get to that point.
He, terrible free throw shooter, which Hill is actually pretty good. So, yeah, I mean, imagine he's a, and let's see, he put up about 4 rebounds and assists in it. So, let's say he puts up similar amount of points, a little bit more rebounds and assists than Bruce Bowen, but what would he have to be? 85% the defender, 90% what Bruce Bowen was? I mean,
yeah, at least. Yeah, he's got to be 90% of Bruce Bowen. He's got to take the hardest person every night, and some nights make those guys look like they're working really hard.
Yeah. See, for me, I know it's kind of a cop-out. I don't know how much I care about the stats as much as I just want him to be a guy that whose defender, when he's off the ball, is within 6 to 8 feet and not playing 10, 12 feet off. Like, I just want him to be respected. I wouldn't mind if on literally every possession somebody else shot the ball, because there will be a better scorer on every single possession. But where he would hurt the team is if he was Alonzo G-esque, where people just played way off him, and then even when they kicked it out to him, nobody ran out to him, and it just
and then G would drive anyways.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want him to be respected, but I don't really need the gaudy points and stats. But then again, I know a lot of people will say, well, it's a new era of contracts. But even in the old era of contracts, it's about $7 million a year. which is what you would normally pay your fifth or sixth best player. So it's fairly significant. So, yeah. So Andre Roberson, like his per 36, he only took six shot attempts and averaged 8 points a game per 36.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm talking about. If Solomon Hill was just the guy who basically stands in the corner, barely ever touches the ball because you have a lot of other scorers and high usage guys out there, how good would his defense have to be worth that contract?
That's pretty good. And like what I'm always been hoping for with him is Shane Battier. Like, that's what I hope this we get from him is if Shane Battier early on was not a tremendous 3-point shooter and he slowly developed it over the course of his long career. And that's kind of what I hope from Solomon Hill is he starts off as maybe not that great of a 3-point shooter for us, but he slowly develops it as he provides defense and intelligent play for our team.
Yeah. Yeah. In Battier's Houston years, he only averaged 8.8 points a game.
Yeah.
Just a little, 5 points a game in Miami where he was obviously valuable. So yeah, I'm never going to look at the points per game for Hill. What I want to see, hopefully we get the technology soon available to where we could see it with these, but I'm going to be looking at things like the sport view tracker and just how far off his man is when the ball's not in Solomon Hill's hands. Cause I think that's going to affect our offense. All he's got to do is be a threat to knock it down. So yeah, that was a question I had about Solomon Hill. The other one was actually a little earlier in the week. Etwan Moore said that when Gentry met with him, he showed him Rajah Bell's numbers before and after Phoenix. And I had never thought of or heard that comparison before, but obviously I grew up watching basketball in the prime of Rajah Bell. Do you think that's a good comparison? Would he exceed his contract value if he became Rajah Bell? Would you be happy? What do you think about that comparison?
I don't know if, let's see, his contract today. Yeah, Rajah Bell was a guy who was probably a little bit better than a mid-level player, and that's more is right now at what is essentially the mid-level. So, I mean, that's a reasonable expectation and a reasonable desire. Like, I think Rajah Bell, a couple of those years in Phoenix, was edging 14 points a game, wasn't he?
Oh, he went over that. That's why Gentry showed him those stats. I mean, he was at 14.7 points per game those first two seasons. Granted, he was playing a ton of minutes. He was amongst the lead leader in minutes. But his time in Phoenix, he shot 42% from three on about six attempts per game.
Right.
If Moore gave us that, man.
I'd be ecstatic.
Yeah. So I thought that was and even with all that, Bell was always known more for his defense than his offense. I mean, he was a guy that got in Kobe's head, and he was always the one that was put on those guys and was a scrappy dog. So you thought about getting offense from him as just an added bonus, but in Gentry's system, he turned him into a pretty deadly outside threat. I thought it was interesting, but I had never heard that comparison before. Watching more, but both the past and a little bit in this game, I think he could be Bell with even better handles. I thought he handled the ball really well. I don't think he could be a point guard, but I think he could be a combo guard that definitely handles and creates plays.
Well, that's why I was considering him the backup point guard for the team when I wrote my rotation out for him. I had him as a backup point because you're right. I've already looked at the numbers. Pick and roll wise, he is, for a guard, league average. Like what he did last year in Chicago was league average, but that's better than what Eric Gordon ever did in the pick and roll.
Yeah.
That's better than what Norris Cole ever did in the pick and roll. And so you give me a nice league average guy with extremely good shooting ability, especially on catch and shoots, who can also get in it and play defense. I'm excited by that. So I've been meaning to ask you two questions. And now we have one preseason game under our belt. Let's see if you what you say. Which of the new acquisitions excites you the most? Because like most people, when I ask that question, they're all kind of like, it's hard to pick one. And then they go for, like, Terrence Jones because he could be a star and he's being paid nothing. Like, the contract comes into it a little bit. It just in a vacuum. Which of these players do you are you most excited about and you think will have the largest impact on this team coming up?
So just free agent acquisitions, not draft picks?
No, it could be draft picks too. Like anybody new this year who was not on the team last year.
I would definitely say Buddy just because I think he has the most upside, and then tied for second would probably be Etuan Moore and Diallo.
Okay.
You're
that excited about Diallo.
Yeah, I mean, so if you go a year back, Diallo, if you'd go back a year in time and somebody said the Pelicans had the 6th pick and the 30, whatever, 4th, I don't remember, and they got Diallo and Buddy Hield, people would have guessed that Diallo was the 6th pick. I mean, he was top 10 in Draft Express going into that year, and just from the pure potential and upside, I don't see it this year. Like, I think the best-case scenario is Diallo becomes Clint Capela, where he does pretty much nothing this year, but by year two, he could be a really good rotation player, and by year three, you could talk about him starting. So just because I think the hardest thing to do is find a big man that could play with Anthony Davis, and this guy has at least a 10 to 20% chance in a year or two to be a almost ideal complement to Anthony Davis. He's got me really excited. But of all the acquisitions, it would be Etuan Moore and then Langston Galloway right behind him. But I think Etuan Moore, as far as this culture that they want to build and have, he's going to be the guy that kind of fits along with that and grows with these guys. Terrence Jones, I was never excited about, and I'm still not. And if I would have had more time for my pet peeve segment last week, there's nothing that angers me more than the, what is it that people always say, low risk, high reward? Terrence Jones isn't going to be a high reward. Like, it's not, high reward is not something that is per situation. High reward is high reward. They mean to say that he could have a high return on investment. And I know that would be a longer thing to say, and people don't want to say what's actually correct, but that would be actually correct.
So if Terrence Jones turned into Markieff Morris, would that surprise
you? If he turns into anything that is average to above average,
I don't know if Morris actually is above average to me as a power forward, but if he turned into an average starting power forward in the league, it wouldn't shock me.
I would. I would bet on Dante Cunningham over Terrence. I mean, why is that crazy though?
Because Cunningham's terrible.
And Terrence Jones was far worse last year. Why? Just because he had...
I'm not sure he was.
Oh, he was. By any metric you look at, Terrence Jones was, as far as the number of minutes he got per game, I mean, he was either second to last or last in defensive RPM. Like, he was terrible, but it's clouded by the fact...
I'm sorry, I'm going with the eye test with Dante Cunningham. I watched him last year. He's terrible.
Okay, and how much Terrence Jones did you watch, honestly?
I watched, like, the game.
Okay, so, it's all... But if they would have been flipped and Terrence Jones was stinking it up on your favorite team last year and Dante Cunningham was somewhere else and we brought him in, I don't know, I think of this Dante Cunningham guy. He started to hit the three last year and yada yada. Like, we sell ourselves on whatever we want to sell ourselves for. By any metric you could possibly pull up, Dante Cunningham was a better player than Terrence Jones last year. And just because Terrence Jones was a higher draft pick and he had a good year a couple of years ago doesn't mean that it's a given he's going to be. I think Dante Cunningham will be a better NBA player this year, next year, and the year after that than Terrence Jones.
Ugh.
There are worse players in the NBA than Dante Cunningham, Ryan. There are.
I'm not sure there are.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Do you remember having Greg
Norris, Steen- Norris Cole?
Maybe Norris Cole. Do you remember having Greg Steensma on this team?
No, I don't remember that guy. Yeah. I never heard.
There
of
are worse players.
Far I have a very selective memory about some of the players that have been on this
I
roster.
I can tell there are far worse players than Dante Cunningham. Terrence Jones, in my opinion, is one of them. And yeah, he might be a little better but he's not going to be a high reward.
All right, well, let me ask you the second question, because we haven't ever gotten your actual take on him. And it's not Tim Frazier, my boy. I love Tim Frazier. Anyone who doesn't know that, watch me on Twitter. You'll see I like Tim Frazier very quickly. Mr. Buddy. So after Summer League, pretty much everybody wrote off Buddy. They're like, oh, Buddy struggled with Summer League. He shot 36% from the field. He couldn't run a pick and roll and was terrible. Buddy Hield's not going to turn into anything in the NBA because our projection says not. So
everybody said that?
I am not everybody. Not everybody. Everybody's saying, so you know what they're not talking about,
oh,
though?
Oh, what?
So when you watched Buddy Hield in the Summer League, did you see like something there that really worried you? Because my takeaway from watching Buddy Hield in Summer League, I didn't watch him and think, oh, my God, he can't do this. Oh, my God, he can't do that. I watched him and saw he can do this and this, and he's not very good at these things yet. And you could easily slot in a very distinct role for him that isn't scary at all on the NBA stage. But it felt like a lot of people were writing him off because he couldn't shoot. So,
I mean, anybody,
what was your take on Buddy?
Anybody who thinks he can't shoot is a freaking idiot.
Well, that he couldn't do anything but shoot, maybe, it, is the way to say
so
it.
So I went into Summer League thinking his ceiling was like a B-. I would have taken Jamal Murray, I think. You know, I made that pretty clear, and, you know, that's fine. But I wasn't upset with Buddy Hield. I thought maybe he had a B- ceiling, but I thought he had a C floor, so it was a safe pick. I left Summer League thinking that he had that same C floor, but that he had a B ceiling. I saw it totally different. And again, that's what I talked about at the beginning of this podcast, is I don't care about points. Buddy's going to take those same shots, and on some days he's going to hit, and on others he wasn't. I was really impressed with his passing. I knew he was a below-average ball handler. I knew that he was going to have problems with off-ball D like any rookie would. I was surprised that he could make plays for others. So I actually left Summer League more optimistic about Buddy Hield than I went into it, because he had all the faults that I thought he would have. Shots are random. Some days they're going to go in, some days they're not, so I don't care about that. But he was a better playmaker than I thought he was coming into that, so I don't get what everybody was talking about.
Okay.
But
let me play a game of over under for you. Over under 0.5 all star appearances for Buddy Hield.
I think he'll luck into one, or you know, one season will break his way.
So you think he'll be that good?
I think he will do what people care about and score the basketball. I think he has a personality, so he'll always be in the loved and in the news. I think at some point the Pelicans or some team that he's on is going to be having a good year, and he's going to be putting up points and doing it in the way that everybody likes to see now with the 3-point shot. So yeah, I said his ceiling was Mitch Richmond and his likely outcome was JJ Redick. And you know, I think if things would have broke a different way or in a different time, J.J. Redick could have made an all-star game. So, yeah, I think he'll luck into one.
Okay. All right.
So I just got a couple more for you.
Sure.
So we saw the starting lineups in this game. Gentry said to take nothing from it. But the starting guards in this game were Etuan Moore and Langston Galloway, obviously. Buddy and Frazier off the bench. Until Drew comes back, would you always go with one starting lineup, or might it be a situation in which your starting guards would be matchup dependent? And if so, what would you be looking for in the matchup to switch up who your guards are?
Honestly, I would stick with a single rotation at guard. And the only reason why I say that is I don't feel there is a major difference between Galloway and Moore as far as what you're getting from either one of them defensively. So my preferred rotation always has one of those two guys on the floor and one of the other two guards on the floor in Frazier and Held. So, and I'm saying his name wrong already, Healed. That's ridiculous. I don't look at other guards and think, oh, I think Moore will be better on that guy, or Galloway will be better on that guy, or Frazier is going to be better guarding that guy. I really just think you have one of those two guys in there at home all times for defensive purposes, and you have one of those guys in there for offensive purposes. And if they both go in at the same time, it's not bad. It's just that's my take. Do you think that they should be matchup dependent entirely?
I think you can make an argument for it. So here's my thing. You're playing the Houston Rockets. You have to start Tim Frazier. Because Galloway and Moore are both fine combo guards. Healed could handle it a little bit. But if you have two of those three guys out there, whatever two, Beverly is just going to press the crap out of and basically make their life a living hell. So you would need Frazier out there to have a top-end true point guard ball handler. But there's other teams that don't have a guy like that. You know, same with the Celtics. You cannot put two combo guards out there against the Celtics because they will press you and they'll force you into turnovers and it'll be a nightmare. But there's teams out there that don't have, you know, a defensive-minded little gnat like that.
Most teams don't.
Yeah. So at that point, I wouldn't mind starting, you know, the first game of the season against Denver. I think you could start Galloway and Moore and get away with it, or Galloway.
I think the more important thing, though, is why would you do Galloway and Moore? Like, let's say Healed is going to be off the bench, and regardless, like, why would you not have Frazier in that starting lineup at all times just to have that ball handler out there? What does Moore and Galloway give you that's better than that?
Okay, think about it. What the other half of the court?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just a mad kind of. I mean, it's a major up. You take Tim Frazier and go to either Galloway or Moore, and that's a big upgrade. So okay. That's what I'm saying. Against teams that don't have pesky defensive guards but maybe have two offensive-minded guards that you don't want to get off and go crazy and start the game hot, then you start two defensive guards who could kind of combo handle the ball and you could get away with that. So that's the situation where I think it could be matchup dependent. Like I would really consider starting those two against Denver because I don't think they'll hurt you on the offensive end, and I think they'll help you on the defense. So I think that could be. And then the other one I wanted to ask you is, and where this actually comes from, is Alvin Gentry said that, you know, he's not necessarily going to start a traditional center every game. And basically on some matchups, he can envision Anthony Davis starting at the center. So just off the top of your head, or, you know, teams that you think about, who are some teams or what type of quote unquote center do you think you could get away with Anthony Davis starting at the center position against?
So I actually saw you say something similar to this on Twitter, and your list of teams seemed really tiny to me.
Shouldn't it be?
No.
Okay.
If I'm talking about Anthony Davis guarding the other team center, I only think there's like five teams that I'm actually worried about him doing that. Like, and I'm not saying he's going to be doing it the whole game, but There aren't a lot of really big centers that I feel are...
Let's go real quick then. Dwight Howard. You want him guarding Dwight Howard?
Sure.
See, I think we're already... I was going to go through this and I thought we were going to agree on most, but we're obviously going to disagree. And Okay, go ahead.
So, like, in Dwight Howard's case, Dwight Howard is probably going to manhandle him around in the middle, right? But are you worried... If Dwight Howard gets the ball entered to him on the post... Is this a bad thing?
Yeah, so you're...
For you?
You're,
no, not really.
And see, this is where I think a lot of the... And you and I talked about AD at center before but years ago. And I think in theory and in a vacuum it makes sense. But what you're talking about is in a single game, could Anthony Davis guard Dwight Howard, and would that be beneficial to the Pelicans? I think you would say definitely. But in an 82-game season where this guy has gotten injured every year and you want to keep him from getting beat up, like, anybody, go play rec basketball and go cover and play against a big man versus a guy who spends his time on the perimeter. It's not just when he's posting up. It's every minute of the game. His body's on you. He's leaning on you. You got to box him out instead of boxing out Millsap. You're getting banged, and you know you're underneath the basket instead of out on the perimeter. Like, there's dozens of hits a game that that Anthony Davis is going to be getting playing center, playing against Dwight Howard versus if he's at power forward versus Millsap. And I think we talk about it too much in a vacuum and whether he could do it. But I don't think that this staff, nor would Anthony Davis, want to put him on Dwight Howard in a regular season game when it's a marathon. I just don't think they would do that. Could he do it? Of course.
Okay.
But I think that's...
Then I'll agree with you. Like, in a marathon situation, they probably would not put Dwight Howard is not the person you would put him on.
Brooke Lopez?
No, I wouldn't do Brooke Lopez.
Robin Lopez?
I don't think of Robin as that physical, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just... My list was really small. Like, Charlotte, I would definitely do it against Cody Zeller. But the Pistons, Drummond, no...
I wouldn't do OKC because Cantor and Adams are going to beat the snot out of them.
Houston, I said I would do. Clint Capella. Indiana, I said I would do. Miles Turner. But, like, and this is where some people disagreed with me, the Clippers and DeAndre Jordan. There's no way.
No, that's a bad idea. I would do Orlando with Vucevic. I would do Denver because I'm not really that worried about Jokic or Nurkic. Nurkic is a big boy, but I'm not worried about him. Milwaukee, I'd let him play against Monroe or whatever. John Henson. Like,
yeah, Milwaukee was on my list. Houston, Indiana.
Washington, you worried about Gortat or?
So what do we keep saying? When you keep saying worried about, like
do you think that? So like, what's really the case here is these guys are going to get physical and push him around and tire him out more than we want him to be tired out in one particular 82 game, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, do you think of, like, I think of those being, like, guys who are really going to get into it with him, push him around, really battle him hard, throw elbows left and right, and I don't think of Gortat and Mahin, well, maybe Mahinmi might do it. That's what I'm trying to think of is, like, physical centers who are going to be, like, this Davis guy, I'm going to toss his ass around.
No, but so I think of it like this. If you played the Washington Wizards 82 times in one universe you played them 82 times and you covered Gortat, and the other you played them 82 times and you covered Markieff Morris, how many more injuries, bumps and bruises, you know, wear and tear would you get in the Gortat versus the Morris? And I think it would be significant over 82 games.
Okay.
So, like, again, of course, it's a matchup. It's matchup heaven if Gortat's got to come out and cover him or if he's got to be chasing Solomon Hill. I get it more than anybody else about how much of a benefit Anthony Davis at center is. But they're not going to do it. And even when people point to Draymond Green, he did it 10 minutes per game. And then when it got to the playoffs, he did it much more. I think it's much more like that than Anthony Davis, even though, yes, in a vacuum, one game, Anthony Davis playing at center and Dwight Howard having to try to figure out how to chase him around is so beneficial. I just don't think they do it. But you would say your list is closer to 12 to 15 teams you would start Anthony Davis at center?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, mine's like 5 to 7. So I'm curious to see what we do, but I'm glad that Gentry's at least open to that.
Yeah, actually, you know what my take actually of that statement is? It's shots fired at Ashiq. I think a lot of what this preseason has been is emphasizing to Ashiq that last year he was garbage, and they're not putting up with it at all. Like, and at the end of last year was that too. They benched his ass when they didn't need to. And I think the fact that he's coming in and they're basically they didn't start him in the first preseason game. He's already said, I'm going to start Davis sometimes. It's going to be matchup dependent. Ajinsa is obviously very sure that he's going to have a clear shot at starting center based on his statements. I think this is a very clear indication that Gentry told Ashiq and told Ajinsa and told Davis, look, Ashiq, if you don't play well, you're not playing, period. I don't care how much money you make.
That is so interesting because you and I did not do a rundown or talk about what we're going to talk about this episode, but that's the last one I had is Omer. I'm going to piss the listeners off. I'm going to call him Omer Asik. And we'll just keep going back and forth and give listeners no clear idea of what we think his last name is. But anyway, I was thinking about the last time we really saw Omer off the bench in a significant role, and it was with those Chicago teams. And they had a second unit. They had a couple of them, but one was absolutely amazing. Those the Chicago team, the elite team, their best lineup, and this lineup played a lot. It was actually fourth in minutes of all their lineups. And Omer was on it, and they were plus 35.6 points per 100 possessions. Wow. For a lineup that was played a lot. This isn't one of those.
Did it have Gibson on it too?
So, yeah, and all of the lineups with Omer coming off the bench had Gibson on it. But what they basically did is their starters were very offensive-minded. I mean, they had Derrick Rose, Carlos Boozer, etc. And then they would bring this bench unit in at the end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter. And for six-minute stretches, they would just basically try to outscore people 8-2. And they would seriously hold people to 2 points for six-minute stretch. I mean, they were just all defense. So with the exception of one guy, so the lineup kind of changes a little bit, but it's basically Omer, Taj Gibson, and then either Luol Deng, Corey Brewer, or really young, not good yet, Jimmy Butler at small forward. And then John Lucas III and Kyle Korver in the backcourt. So you basically have John Lucas III, who's kind of Tim Frazier-like. Yeah. You got a great, you know, but he wasn't Kyle Korver then. He was an okay shooter. And then you just have this defensive-minded front court, and they're like, hey, we're going to give our starters a break, and we're going to try to outscore you 8-2. If the Pelicans wanted to copy that model around Omer coming off the bench, would it be possible? What lineup would you put together to try to make that happen?
I'm going to have to see Hill play more, but I would guess it would be, and that, since I don't know enough about Hill at power forward, I would say it's Ashiq, Cunningham. Who beat the small forward? Maybe Moore with Heald as your buddy time scorer and Galloway as your point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, do you think that there's any chance that by the end of the year, because the thing that was so effective about Gibson and Ashiq is the rebounding rate was insane. Those
yeah.
two.
Diallo could do something there. Cunningham can't rebound anything.
Yeah. Yeah, those guys could gobble up boards. But I'm just curious, you know, if Omer came off the bench, because a lot of four of Chicago's nine best lineups that year were Omer off the bench with Taj Gibson, Kyle Korver. Those were the three that were constant in every lineup. And then you had either a C.J. Watson or a John Lucas. That's why I think you might actually need Frazier. And then you had a wing like Brewer, Luol Deng, or a young, not good yet, Jimmy Butler. So,
right.
Yeah, I think it could be interesting with Omer coming off the bench, but we're a ways from there.
Okay. All right. Talked a lot about the team there. We're now going to move on to the Central Division, which is the most boring, weird division in the entire league, which honestly, a lot of these teams could win 34 games. I wouldn't be shocked. And several of them could win 48 games, and I wouldn't be shocked even a little bit. So of course, Cleveland's in there too. If they won 34 games, I would be shocked. I guess that's not really accurate. But let's move on. We're going to start with the Chicago Bulls.
I'm going to stop the podcast there and split this thing in half like I did the last one. If you want to hear the Central Division preview, and I'm sure you do, come back tomorrow. See ya.